It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're going to talk about how corporations can adopt practices that are environmentally responsible and still make money. Your thoughts are welcome at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. First, we're recapping a year's worth of in-depth reporting from our WisconTex team with managing editor Christian Knutson. Christian, we appreciate your time.
Thank you for speaking with me.
We saw some big themes emerge in the top stories that WisconTex had in 2019. What are you noticing?
WisconTex tries to look at stories with a long-term point of view. We like to see how stories unfold over weeks, months, and years. And we look not only forwards, but backwards. So we really draw upon history and looking at how history informs current issues. And then we look at how people are seeing how issues might develop into the future, whether that's in coming months or coming decades. So if you look at our top stories of the year, they really fit those themes of how did history inform kind of contemporary, you know, issues in the state, and how we're looking ahead to how things may change or may stay the same.
One aspect of that is climate change. We see it coming up in a couple of different ways in popular WisconTex stories. What did you cover and what can we kind of glean from that?
Yeah, we try to cover the ways that scientists are projecting how climate change can affect the state. And so one of the stories looks at research into how temperature analogs are potentially going to be felt in cities across the state in about 60 years. So what somebody living in Wausau might feel like, actually they're living in somewhere a little farther to the south, or if you're living in Milwaukee, that might be more like you're living in the Philadelphia area, and so on and such forth. It's a story about research into how Wisconsin communities will feel warmer like other places already feel in the nation.
Sure. If we're watching the climate change and even we eke up just a few degrees, what might that look like in Wisconsin? And I think some of that research is certainly fascinating and shows up there. You've also looked at the wet weather and what people are facing in Wisconsin.
Yeah, as well as looking at the science, we're looking at the ways that the kind of changes that are happening are already being felt. And one of our biggest projects this year was looking at what happened when there was a series of three storms over 6 years in northwest Wisconsin. There were major torrential rainstorms in 2012, 2016, and 2018 in Douglas, Bayfield, Ashland counties, and the surrounding area that really just inundated many of these areas, washed out roads and bridges, washed out culverts again and again and again. And we wanted to look at how are local governments looking to deal with this issue? How are they looking to pay for this infrastructure that is getting damaged and damaged time after time, and just how they're planning to prepare for the future as more of this is expected to be coming their way.
And what should we think about when we realize that those are some of the most clicked on stories from WisconTex? People must care.
Yeah, I think that people are interested in really the in-depth types of one of our colleagues uses the term longitudinal, which is kind of an academic term for ways of looking at the news that you look at the same issue point after, you know, time after time after time at the same point and seeing what's changing, what's staying the same, and what that means for the overall picture.
Okay, so we're taking the things that we're seeing and experiencing every day and really putting them, well, I guess, into context.
Exactly.
That would be the point. Sounds good. What also about the dairy industry? Wisconsin's collapsing dairy industry on a lot of people's minds, and WisconTex did a deep dive that shows up on the list.
Yeah, we've been looking at the dairy industry and some of its difficulties the past few years, and we did kind of a bigger piece this past spring that looked at a lot of the in-depth numbers that kind of define what's changing in the dairy industry. So we're looking at milk prices, the volume of cheese in cold storage in the United States, the number of cows versus the number of farms, the total milk exports. A lot of these economic trends and looking at how their change over the past six, seven, eight, even nine decades has, you know, influenced the dairy industry and what has really been happening in the past few years that is different from these longer term trends.
You put together a lot of fascinating, visually stimulating charts and diagrams. Why do you incorporate so much of the visual when we're talking about numbers and other representations?
Well, we want people to be able to visualize these oftentimes very abstract issues and hopefully help them better understand the ways that these very complex economic dynamics are affecting people's livelihoods. You know, unless you actually live this issue day to day, you aren't going to understand it. But hopefully getting to know some of these numbers will help people who might just only see this or hear about it on the radio or talk with people about it, get a better picture of the kind of global dynamics that are affecting what's happening with the industry.
We're talking about top stories from WisconText in the year 2019. We've got managing editor Christian Knutson here in the studio and looking at what stood out and really what that says about our state. I'm Keely Boltina. Christian, what was the most unusual story that you saw gain traction this year?
One of the most fun stories, I would say, is this is another dairy industry story. Is we did a look at the just massive explosion in the goat dairy industry in the state. So at the same time that the dairy industry in the state is having a lot of difficulties, that's essentially related to the dairy cow milk industry. Goats, on the other hand, are just burgeoning in terms of the number of goats in the state and the economic value of the dairy goat industry in the state. It was a really kind of fun story to learn about because you're hearing all about this one very distressing and problematic issue with the dairy industry. But at the same time, albeit much smaller, there are some bright spots, and that is what this dairy goat story was trying to look at.
And it's also generally fun to talk about goats. They're fun creatures to discuss. I love it. I like that you're able to not just look at problems, but also where people are finding solutions. And I think that shows up throughout the WisconText pieces. Is that an important thing to look at it from lots of perspectives?
Absolutely, yes. These story that we've been talking about have been reported by Will Cushman, who's our primary reporter. And we work, Will and I and our other collaborators, and especially the contributors who are other academics who contribute to WisconText or other reporters, we're trying to really look at the broadest picture possible with these stories. And again, we think about the long term. How are things changing or developing over time? It's really about that that biggest picture that, you know, sometimes might feel difficult or, you know, outside your lived experience because you're living it day to day, but these things really oftentimes take a long time to develop.
Other stories that made your top list include some water quality conversations about lakes, invasive species, some insects. Christian, what was your favorite story this year?
My favorite story probably was that goat story, but I also like the story about the flooding in Northwest Wisconsin. I happened to be in Duluth and Superior during the 2016 and 2018 rainstorms and experienced them firsthand. And it was just really amazing to see what was happening on the ground there. And then years later, go back and see this is still an ongoing issue. This is a problem and a cost that local communities are still struggling to deal with. And so that was really fascinating. And we're going to be continuing to look at that issue going forward in the new year.
Oh, yeah. What topics do you expect to see in 2020?
Well, in 2020, one of the big things we're going to be doing no matter what is we work with Wisconsin Public Radio and we work with PBS Wisconsin to help build upon their reporting. So we're going to be looking a lot at political issues, the election that's coming up. And what we tend to focus on are kind of the demographics of elections, the demographics of politics, and kind of the mechanisms and data of politics. So we're going to be looking at hopefully things like bellwether counties and like political changes in different geographic areas and things like that.
All right, Christian, thanks so much for recapping 2019 with us.
Thank you very much.
That was Christian Knutson, managing editor of our WisconText team. We were talking about top stories from this year. You can read all of those that we mentioned and more at wisconText.org. Up next, are environmental responsibility and making money really at odds? Or do you think companies can help the earth and still turn a profit? We're talking about how corporations can benefit from conservation. And there's room for you in the discussion. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can email ideas at WPR.org to be part of our conversation. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. This morning, we're talking about the relationship between nature and corporations. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Our guest says companies need to do more than organize an annual Earth Day cleanup to make a difference. And by going green, they can make green. What do you think? What role should companies play in addressing our changing climate? Does your employer have a sustainability plan? Do you think it's effective? You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Any way you'd like to join us, we'll take your questions, your comments. With Margaret O'Gorman, she's president of the Wildlife Habitat Council. She led the design of their conservation certification, a sustainability standard for corporations. Margaret, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you, Keely. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
It's good to talk with you, too. Your new book is called Strategic Corporate Conservation Planning, A Guide to Meaningful Engagement. You know, being environmentally responsible could be good business these days. It seems good for the brand. It's not always effective, though. Talk to us about the idea of greenwashing. What do you mean there?
Yeah, greenwashing is, I think, a very real risk when businesses claim to be more environmentally friendly than they are, whether it's in terms of how they produce the products that they are selling, or even how their impact on the earth is being mitigated. So it's very important, especially in these days when environmentally sustainable products are more popular with consumers and gaining in popularity, that consumers are aware that the claims that companies are making with respect to how environmentally friendly they are, that they're clear, they're transparent, and it's very obvious that the claims can be backed up with fact. I think there's a lot of groups watching out for greenwashing these days, but that's certainly a risk as consumers move to more eco-friendly products.
An example of this that you give actually has to deal with one of the movies popular at my house, which is The Lorax, the Dr. Seuss book adapted for the screen. Some big names with the voicing in that and everything. But it was used as a marketing tool with Mazda, right?
That's right. Yes. Mazda, I'm not sure what marketing company advised them to do it, but they decided to attach their brand to the Lorax, which, as we know, the Lorax is the keeper of the earth, and it was not an electric car that they were producing or a hybrid car. It was just a normal gas-emitting combustion engine car, and it was very much an attempt to try and make their product seem as if it was acceptable to somebody as iconic as the Lorax. And as I say in the book, it wasn't just environmental groups that complained about this or consumer groups that complained about this. It was actually the auto industry also felt that it was a serious misstep on behalf of Mazda.
So that greenwashing is really misrepresentation.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
What about this concept of corporate social responsibility? How is that idea taking hold?
Yeah, corporate social responsibility is really an idea that dates back to the 1930s and the 1950s, but really started to take hold, I would say, in the 1970s and 80s. And it's the idea that a company is responsible for more than the value that it returns to shareholders. Milton Friedman, the Nobel Prize winning economist, has famously said that the only value that companies should give is that which they return to their shareholders. But there's been an increasing recognition that companies have more responsibility. They exist in communities. They extract resources from the planet. They employ people. So they have responsibilities beyond the mere products that they're producing and the shareholder value. And we have seen over the last 30 years, I think, a really great burgeoning of interest and of acceptance by companies that they have more responsibility than purely money. And that has certainly come to very prominence in the last few years when a number of big institutions, whether it's the BlackRock Finance Group or a business group, that basically said that companies need to be better and to do better.
Margaret O'Gorman is the president of the Wildlife Habitat Council. She led the design of their conservation certification. And there's room for you in our discussion about corporate responsibility and the environment. What do you wonder? What are you thinking about the responsibilities of each side? As global efforts to combat climate change stall, do you think the industry should step up? There's room for you at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Margaret, you lived in New Jersey. Tell us how that region helped you understand how business is really connected to conservation.
Sure, yes. I live in the Washington, D.C. area right now. But when I lived in New Jersey, it's a fascinating state from the point of view of how to incorporate nature into a landscape that has been heavily developed and heavily developed over centuries. And there's a number of kind of people's perception of New Jersey is that it's very industrialized. It's the New Jersey Turnpike, it's pollution. But within that state, they have managed to do two things very well. One of them is protect the really important ecosystems, the really important nature-based areas of the New Jersey Pine Barrens, which is 1.1 million acres in southern New Jersey, basically a third of the state. They've protected that through planned development and through a suite of regulations that are focused on protecting the ecosystem. And they've done the same in the highlands of New Jersey, which is a big water source for the state. So they've really used planning in a way that has been very beneficial to nature. But the other thing that they've done, which I really and personally think is fantastic, is they've managed to restore previously unproductive places for nature, well, previously polluted places that became unproductive, and have made these fabulous nature areas in very intense urban areas. So Liberty State Park in New Jersey is a key, it's an iconic place because it was a railway yard that was completely polluted for centuries, and they've cleaned it up, and it's now become an amazing amenity for both people and nature. And I think one of the key messages from working in the environment in New Jersey is to think about how nature can, if given the opportunity, can actually bounce back quite quickly.
And how important then is it for those companies to involve the local communities then in those conservation and environmental efforts like you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. It's absolutely vital. I think a company who is either attempting to do just ecological stewardship on their lands or a company that is attempting to do ecological restoration or remediation following damage has to include the community, because the community are the ones who live there, and the community members are the ones who are going to be there well after the company has gone. And they're really the ones that understand what's necessary and what they want and what they would benefit from. So the best restoration programs that I have seen have been ones where there have been really meaningful community engagement and ongoing community engagement. So engagement not just in the planning, but also in the implementation and also in the kind of management of it. There's a program that I know with Waste Management, the solid waste haulier group, national group, where in Pennsylvania, they have basically connected pollinator gardens on their solid waste landfill to pollinator gardens in a retirement community and pollinator gardens in a middle school, to have this three generations of pollinator gardens, and they all work together and connect their efforts into kind of a bigger pollinator effort, but then create this sense of community around these three discrete efforts. And it's a very successful program that helps the company secure its social license to operate, but also helps the community have an amenity that they can get engaged with.
Let's welcome Jeremy from Racine to the conversation now. Jeremy, what are your thoughts?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I recommend a lot of people read a book called Getting Green Done. It's been authored by a gentleman that works for the Sierra Club. For being on the front lines for like 20-some years, he goes over his experiences trying to convert existing businesses and new businesses to take on a new green model, but it always doesn't seem to work out the way it looks. It sounds good, but it doesn't really work well on paper when you start working out the math. And even the Sierra Club, being the front lines of environmental, and they even refuse to make changes in their own business models because of the perception for hospitality towards their customer base, because they are ski resorts and stuff like that.
And Jeremy, thanks for that call. And Margaret, we're going to get much more into this as our conversation continues, but it's important that businesses see the effect of their changes when it comes to going green.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what Jeremy said is a very good observation, is that, you know, there needs to be a benefit to the companies. The benefit does not need to be a bottom line dollar benefit. It can be a benefit around employee engagement or a benefit around securing their social license to operate, as I mentioned, with waste management. In the book, I outline basically 16 business benefits that companies can have from doing meaningful conservation with their employees.
And we'll talk more about that in just ahead. We've got Margaret O'Gorman staying with us. She's written a book with strategies for companies to help the environment and still make money, find other benefits. Our conversation continues, and you're part of it at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you think and what the relationship looks like for you between corporations and environmental conservation. I'm Keely Boltina. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about corporations and the environment. Our guest says advocates for a healthy planet have to accept that many companies are not going to go green simply on moral terms. It often requires a financial incentive. And she says that's okay, because sustainability is a profitable option for businesses. What do you think? Do you find that you support companies because of their environmental efforts and initiatives? Or do you avoid buying from companies that you feel like don't respect the environment? Maybe you're part of an organization, a leader, or someone working the front lines with an environmentally friendly plan. What efforts is your company putting forth to make a difference? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Margaret O'Gorman has consulted with international businesses on how to craft real effective strategies, and she's written a new book called Strategic Corporate Conservation Planning. Margaret, let's talk about this concept that businesses are finding success in those environmental efforts. Let's talk about the company Method. Why is their model for corporate responsibility working?
Well, Method as a company has... it became a company as a B Corp, which is basically a company that says in its mission and in all of its filings that it is going to put some of its profits back into the environment, and also that it's going to be an environmentally and socially conscious company in all of its activities and the way it approaches everything. So Method as a company, it produces household cleansers and things like that. So it really thinks about the ingredients, very simply the ingredients in its products, but also the packaging of its products and how the packaging can be used at end of life, how recyclable it is, how much energy is used to make those products. And it also has a facility in Northwest Indiana, I think, or outside of Chicago, which they have built, which is an environmentally friendly facility in an underserved community. So every choice that the leaders in Method make around products, around new products, around where to work and how to work, has got a socially conscious ethos around it. And they really set themselves up as that. And we're seeing a bigger growth in those sorts of companies, B Corps, coming online in the last few years. And we're certainly expecting to see an acceleration of that in coming years, because many people understand that, especially younger consumers, the younger generation, whether millennials or others, really see and look into the chain of custody of a product. Where was it made? Who made it? What went into it? And what does the company stand for? And they are becoming buying decisions for a lot of people these days.
And there are layers to this, though, because if I have a product, with a name and a retail customer to satisfy, that's one thing. But I don't necessarily know, or maybe I need to know where these products are coming from, how they're being sourced, conditions under which everything is being made before it even gets to me to put together as a final product. How do we handle that, all of that in the background, when there's no consumer to keep people accountable?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because there's so much that goes into the product that we purchase in a store or from a car dealer. And the companies that are further up the supply chain are being held accountable by both the trade associations that they belong to, but also by the people who are buying from them. So a company like, for example, Toyota Motors is saying to the steel industry and is saying to the copper industry, we need you to tell us where you're sourcing your product from. And within the copper industry, the there are international copper trade associations that are basically saying, you can join us, but only if you can show us where your products are coming from. So all of these things are really great and positive. How it trickles down to the consumer is much more difficult, because when you think about a car, the amount of elements in a single car are huge. There's thousands of pieces of plastic and copper and metal. So how does a customer know? And I think that's a big challenge to companies at the moment, is being able to talk about that and show that.
I can see where it might be hard for consumers to believe that corporations are genuine in trying to make a difference, especially with a history of pollution. How do we reconcile that when there's some inherent mistrust?
Oh, yes, there absolutely is inherent mistrust. And when I was writing the book, I was able to kind of trace the history of industrial mismanagement and how industrial pollution back in the days before Environmental Protection Agency, before the Clean Water Rules, how companies back then just really did not think about their impact on the environment. And there has been quite a substantial evolution in how companies, both because they're regulated, but also because of corporate social responsibility, that they are viewing their impact on the planet in a much different way. So I think as time and distance happens with companies, and companies also tend to project now, they're more transparent than they've ever been, which is a great thing. But I think there will always be mistrust, because companies are so large and because it's very difficult to get the information out there in a very clear way. But I think there's a huge difference in how companies manufacture today compared to how they manufactured back in the 1950s and before EPA.
We're talking with Margaret O'Gorman about the relationship between environmental groups and business interests. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. As global efforts to deal with our changing climate are kind of in flux, do you think that corporations have an opportunity to step up? What do you think that relationship looks like between companies and environmental change? And do you think it's possible that companies can benefit financially from making changes that actually help our planet? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also email us your ideas, your concerns, your thoughts and criticisms at ideas@wpr.org. I just referenced our changing climate, Margaret. It's the biggest environmental issue of our time. And as government response to that climate crisis changes, pulls back, are you seeing companies show more interest in leading that battle?
Mm-hmm. Yes. First of all, I'd say that both the climate change crisis and the biodiversity crisis are equally challenging. The biodiversity crisis, which is the loss of nature, gets less press than climate, but they're both very pressing planetary issues at the moment. So, but when it comes to climate change, I think that companies are more progressive in many ways than our governments currently are. Many companies are working on energy transitions or transitions of production, where they're looking at their products and really thinking about how their products can be made in ways that have reduced greenhouse gases, how their products can be used in ways that reduce the greenhouse gases that they're putting out, and how the entire supply chain can change from that point of view. And one of the areas of the book that I focus on with respect to climate is getting companies to think about how they can actually use nature to both mitigate, reduce their greenhouse gas emissions, but also to allow them to adapt and to better adapt to the increasingly violent storms that we're going to see by using nature-based solutions for those two things. So I think when you see companies and nature-based solutions and climate coming together, there can be really great progress made. It's not incredibly expensive and it's not incredibly complex. So I think there's a really clear way where companies can use their lands to harness the power of nature to mitigate some of the damage that they are doing.
Well, and you note that 80% of biodiversity is on private lands. So on that front, mm-hmm. what role should these companies play in increasing and restoring that biodiversity that you've talked about?
Yeah, there's so much that companies can do, from very simple management of their landscapes. I mean, companies have vast land holdings, but they go across a spectrum of, when you think about the corporate headquarters and the, you know, the formal landscaping and the big lawns that cost a lot of money to maintain, right through to factories, which are the same, but through to, say, mine and quarry sites. At every single one of these sites, companies, if they can just change the way that they're doing their nature-based management, their landscaping management, can make a huge difference to the biodiversity crisis. And you're right, 80% of biodiversity is on private lands. So it's on private lands that actually the biodiversity crisis is going to be stopped and is going to be reversed. And it's really about getting companies to think in different ways, in innovative and imaginative ways, about how they can use their lands. I talk about a steel mill in northwest Indiana on the shores of Lake Michigan that has basically created habitat for piping plovers and other beach nesting birds that use the Great Lakes area. And they've done that on an active steel mill. And their habitat is better in many ways than the habitat that's right across the fence from them, which is a national park, purely because it's protected from human disturbance. So it doesn't have to be pristine lands. It doesn't have to be wild lands. It can actually be any lands that a company owns that can have a benefit for nature.
And it sounds like perhaps that translates into individual landowners too.
Yes, absolutely. Anybody who owns lands can participate in this. Individual landowners, corporate landowners, and of course, government landowners.
Excellent. Our conversation with Margaret O'Gorman continues. She's author of a new book called Strategic Corporate Conservation Planning. And we're talking about this idea of environmental preservation, environmental safety, and business development, how they haven't always gone hand in hand. Maybe there's potential now for companies to see the benefits of sustainability. And we want to hear from you. Does your employer have a sustainability plan? Do you think it's effective? Maybe you have taken steps on your own to make your workplace more friendly toward the environment. Was it successful? Did you feel like you made a difference? You can call 800-642-1234 and tell us about that. You can also weigh in, do you think companies are having a positive impact? Do you think they see that they can make money while being environmentally sound? Or do you think that the bottom line will always win out and that corporations aren't going to be able to adapt? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Our conversation continues here on The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and this is the Ideas Network. We're talking about corporations and what they can do to resist a changing climate without losing out on their bottom lines. It's The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina. We're going beyond the big picture theories about conservation and digging into the reality that businesses need to make money to survive, and yet perhaps they could take more responsibility for our world. What do you think? Would you support a business carbon tax? How do you think companies should be held responsible for pollution? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can join us right here on the Ideas Network. Margaret O'Gorman is the president of the Wildlife Habitat Council, and she led the design of their conservation certification. Margaret, this idea that regulation is bad for business, we hear that come up often, that government involvement can hinder economic growth. How can we get people to think about corporate action and environmental efforts as these joint ventures and not one side telling the other side what to do?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to frame the possibilities. And I think one of the really interesting opportunities for business is when we think about every state, so Wisconsin, New Jersey, whatever, has a state wildlife action plan. And the state wildlife action plan lays out a blueprint for the management of nature, basically wildlife in those states. And every single one of those plans is underfunded and it's under-resourced. So if companies can actually align their conservation efforts with the needs of the state wildlife action plans, what they are doing is not so much a regulated activity at this stage, but they are supporting Wisconsin, you know, DNR or New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. They're actually supporting some of their goals without having to be bound by regulations, because the state wildlife action plans are really focused on common species and keeping common species common. So I think companies have a great opportunity there to see where their footprints are, to see where they're located, and to see what they can do in terms of thinking about supporting the government kind of goals that have been set out by the experts that sit in these government agencies and support that work. And I think that's a great way of looking at it, instead of a government agency coming in and saying, you must do this, you must do that, or you cannot do this or that. But it's what can we do together? And we've seen some very successful partnerships between government agencies, whether it's usually fish and wildlife agencies, helping companies understand how they can use their lands to benefit wildlife, whether it's to provide hibernation for the Indiana bat, or to set aside lands for the gopher tortoise or other species that are even, you know, more common and are not yet listed. Companies have seen great benefit then from having enhanced relationships with the government.
Let's welcome Mackenzie from Eau Claire to this conversation, who wants to weigh in on this idea of regulation. Mackenzie, what are you thinking?
Hi, I just don't think voluntary participation is good enough to solve the crisis that is actually at hand. And any goodwill that's exhibited by these companies is really only an effort to make themselves look good, and it doesn't actually address the issue that we're facing today.
So, Mackenzie, do you think that that the government should be regulating things and holding companies to those standards, or is it more of a partnership for you?
I think at the minimum that we should increase regulations on fossil fuel companies and other industries that are responsible for this. And we should look at nationalizing industries to help benefit, you know, the people who haven't had the power to make change but can make change in the future.
All right, Mackenzie, thanks for that that point there. And Margaret, Mackenzie just saying, you know, expecting companies to figure this out on their own isn't going to work. What do you say to that?
Well, I think he's right in some ways. Expecting companies to figure it out by themselves is not going to work, because it's not their core competency. They, you know, especially when it comes to nature-based work and the biodiversity crisis, they need help. They need to be in partnerships with it. I think the regulations that are in place right now have made a huge difference. Of course they have, from, you know, since the EPA has been put in place and the Clean Water Act. But so much time is spent fighting these regulations that could actually be spent going forward. And I believe that if we can help provide carrots as well as sticks to companies, that we can probably achieve much more than we've achieved in the past. I think sometimes that the antagonistic relationship that has been between the environmental movement in some ways and the companies has halted the abilities of the companies to enter into productive partnerships, because I truly believe that partnerships are where the difference can be made.
Margaret O'Gorman is the president of the Wildlife Habitat Council, and we're having a discussion about environmental responsibility, especially as it comes to corporations and whether that jibes with business development. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org to be part of this conversation. And Margaret, you know, what's different and unique about your approach to corporate conservation is that you show companies why environmental ethics can be good for business. How do you do that?
Yes, so there's a traditional approach that companies take with respect to nature and the environment, and that is an arm's length philanthropic approach. They will write you a check. Write a check to an environmental group, or they will engage communities in beach cleanups or in stream cleanups, but to really integrate and to mainstream thinking about nature into a company's practices, there has to be a business reason to do it. And this is not a bottom line valuing nature reason. This is about a business reason, whether it's connecting to community or, as I said earlier, social license to operate, which is the ability of a company to operate in a community, whether it's to engage employees. If a company has a business reason, they're more likely to place that nature-based work into their operational budgets instead of their foundation and philanthropic budgets. And when it becomes into their operational budgets, it will last longer. And by lasting longer, you have better outcomes for nature. So what we do when I work with a company, the first question I ask is not what's the conservation work you want to do. It's what is the business challenge or opportunity you want to address. And by framing it within the language of business, we create an ability then to mainstream or integrate it into business operations and budgets. And to me, that's what makes a huge difference. Instead of saying it's just purely philanthropic, purely voluntary, purely can be stopped at any stage, this really makes a difference to longevity, which makes a difference to outcomes.
Still now, businesses, of course, have a carbon footprint, and companies, mm-hmm. you know, we've talked about how they've been significant polluters in the past. Does corporate conservation just break even, or is there a real opportunity for positive environmental impact on the part of corporations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it depends on the company. A company that has a very large footprint that is having a big impact on biodiversity or on nature by its operations, so a mine or a quarry, they can actually enhance their lands through active reclamation and remediation work that will actually have a higher biodiversity outcome than the state of the lands before the disturbance. Now, that takes thinking and planning in advance, but it's not impossible. And it's very easy to do that with the right mindset, to think, okay, I know I need to reclaim this mine site or this quarry site. I want to reclaim it with a net benefit for biodiversity compared to the prior use. And this is how I can do it. So they can easily do that. And then when we think of the landscape in more fragmented areas and in more urban areas, again, we can bring a net benefit just by thinking about nature in a different way.
And one last comment, Mary Kay from Kenosha notes that not all corporations are factories. Some are big businesses like apartment mm-hmm. complexes. So, Margaret, different companies need to figure out what that means for them.
Oh, totally. That's such a great observation. So the companies that have a direct impact on the earth through mines and quarries, they understand and they're regulated in many ways. But one of the biggest land uses in the country is parking lots. So how can we think about that in a different way? And certainly there are ways to do that by thinking about design and thinking about how to incorporate nature. So yes, thinking in different ways on different facilities.
Margaret, thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, thank you so much and have a great day.
You too. Margaret O'Gorman is author of the book Strategic Corporate Conservation Planning, A Guide to Meaningful Engagement. She joined us to talk about the relationship between corporations and the environment. This is The Morning Show. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.